remind me why we're doing this.
Okay, we are doing this because it's 100 years since women got the vote, and that feels like a major milestone. And when I was doing my research, the Fawcett Society popped up into my inbox and said, we're looking for some centenary fundraisers. Would you be a fundraiser for us? And it became apparent when I was looking at this that in the campaign for women to get the right to vote, Millicent Fawcett campaigned for 60 years. That's a whole lifetime dedicated to a cause. And it felt appropriate, particularly in the light of Brexit, when actually that had been the first time my youngest daughter had the right to vote, so we went as a family to vote. So it felt really significant, and I wanted to do something to mark the occasion and to really acknowledge the achievements of what those women had succeeded in getting. And actually the conversations that I'm having with people now wouldn't be happening but for the sacrifices those people had made. So I'm walking with you today, Rachel, because I think you've got a lot to say on this. I'm really interested in your background and what you've done and the recognition you've achieved and how you've moved women's rights forward, not just in this country and the work you've done as a previous correspondent, and also the work you continue to do as a coach in supporting and encouraging people of both genders. This is about women, but it's also about men too. And I'm really interested in these conversations to capture both of those perspectives. So as a starting question, what does having the vote mean for you in today's landscape?
I think having the vote is such a responsibility. Look at what happened when Hillary Clinton won more votes but then didn't win the election, and what we have is President Trump. Look at the power of a vote in a country like Russia, where the result is already known before people go to the polls.
Yeah.
When I worked with women and girls in Afghanistan, they did have the vote, but the choice of what to do with the vote was limited, questionable, or misunderstood. So they couldn't exercise the power even though they were supposedly in possession of it. And we are so lucky in England that we've had the vote for women for 100 years. In France, they had to wait till the 60s. In
yes.
parts of Switzerland, regional voting in certain cantons, I believe, still excludes women.
Yeah. And what a frightening thought that is in the 21st century.
And yet it's a frightening thought to have the vote, because we look at Brexit, whatever side you're on, whatever result you thought you wanted, it demonstrates the power of a vote to translate into action, or action that now must be taken and can't be reversed, or we're told it can't be reversed. So it's really made me think of how brave those women were to campaign for the vote amidst violence against themselves,
yes.
and against opposition even from their own spouses. And some of them were working class, they weren't all privileged, and they went without pay in order to demonstrate, in order to vote. In fact, my grandfather described as a working class man how his father had taken a day without pay in order to vote because the polling stations didn't stay open long enough for a working class man to go to work and vote.
Wow.
So this was male empowerment that was needed,
yes.
not so very long ago. And then, of course, hot on its heels, and thank goodness, we now have the female equivalent and an equal right to vote. But that doesn't necessarily mean we have equality yet.
No.
And I'm a big believer in equality of opportunity. I don't think we can make things totally fair. As my mother's maternity nurse, who came to see her back in the 70s when she had her first baby, that was me, that nurse lived to be 100. And she said one day when I was whinging and said, oh, but it's not fair about something. She said, my dear, life isn't fair, so let's get on with it. And I think we do need to do something about lack of fairness,
yes.
especially for those who can't do something about it for themselves. And we need to get on with it. We need to choose our attitude. I think we're more powerful as doers than as people feeling stuck, stuck in victim.
Yes. Where do you stand on the feminism? And do you see yourself as a feminist? What does that mean?
I've never labelled myself with an ism or an ist, and I didn't actually know that feminism existed when I was growing up. And my mother thought that that was a great sign that she'd done it. I remember her standing in her friend's kitchen saying, if Rachel hasn't noticed the difference between how I treat the boys or the girls, then I've done it, haven't I?
Job well done.
And in a sense, I think she really has a point. She would have liked me to go to a mixed school, and the only viable school available was an all-girls school. And within that, of course, nobody questioned whether you were a girl doing science or a girl doing art. You were a girl
doing
coming
science
to school.
Or art. Yeah.
You were a girl who was learning. So I was very lucky in that sense. I'm also really lucky because I have two brothers, and I think that's an education, and that sets women up for success in the wider world. And my mother had a fighting spirit around feminism, but I don't think I had to have that because so much had already happened in the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s. That means, well, that I'm very lucky. So I could go out to work like, well, go to university like the boys, go to work like the boys. I didn't even think about it. I was also taught to be a spin bowler in cricket because my brother was rather good at cricket and he needed extra practice. And my parents would take us all to the local park and off we went with batting and bowling and catching. There was no question that I wouldn't do that because I was a girl. And of course, it's a joy to me to see now that a girls' cricket team and a girls' football team is utterly normal from when children are 5 or 6 and just having a dabble or an after-school activity. I regard that as wonderful, and it's the new normal.
Mm.
And I know of a little girl, she's only 3, but she was on a delayed flight and they very kindly said at the end of it, would any children like to come and see the captain in the cockpit? So she was really excited. Her father took her up to the cockpit and the door was opened, and in there was, you know, the captain, the co-pilot and all the twinkling lights of the cockpit. And the captain turns round and is a woman.
How fantastic.
And the 3-year-old girl doesn't flinch because it's the new normal.
Mm.
Or rather, for her, it's not new, it's just normal.
Yeah.
And her father was thrilled. And I think what we're also going to see is male feminists, men who champion girls because they have daughters. I know a man who was widowed, aged 36, with 3 daughters under 5. And in his workplace, he pioneered a 3-day working week at the same level as you left at post-maternity leave for women. And of course, he would now be extending that for men who are parents of very young children in the workplace. So there are, I think it's really important to acknowledge and welcome and appreciate the contribution of men to women's rights and women's equality. I wouldn't want to continue to create an angry divide of women on one side against them. Because of course, let's consider how families have been reconfigured to have 2 parents of the same sex or all manner of different mergers and combinations. And you want those families to be successful and to raise confident, successful, open, inclusive, kind people.
Yes.
And anybody can teach kindness, and anybody can role model and facilitate equality.
Mm. Feminism has come up, made great strides, and you know, there had to be people who had to put themselves out in difficult, awkward situations in order to move things forward. The bit that's striking me now is what's next on the agenda, because the hashtag MeToo movement is a year old. There was a sense that when the Harvey Weinstein thing started to gather momentum, that there's a new weather front coming through.
The MeToo movement, I feel, really does represent a new weather front coming through. I think this is the era in which you are now believed. If you've been sexually abused, if you have been sexually assaulted, male on male, male on female, female on female, or adult to child. This is the generation where you are believed. You are believed by your family. You are believed by society's institutions. And let's not forget that the justice system, the police system, other aspects of the teaching system, these systems often shut down and shut out people who complained or who brought forward an assault or another criminal act. And that is changing. And organisations are only people. They don't have to be stuck. It's people in them that make them what they are. And I feel inspired to see the openness that the Me Too movement has unleashed. And we are unfortunately seeing malpractice, even in humanitarian aid organisations,
yes,
who purport to be full of people with meaning and purpose and desire to help others. And yet there are abuses of power. The President's Club, Genoa Bridge, any number of world leaders currently whose behaviour is worrying, let's say,
yes,
to put it mildly.
Yes.
And whilst there's so much hope, there is so much work still to do. It would be ridiculous of me to say, you know, I didn't notice the difference when actually I sat next to a chap at work who happened to be paid twice what I was. I thought he was more experienced. As I became more experienced, I realised he wasn't. We were the same. Another person who said, I can't bring up a family on this, I've got a mortgage to pay. He got a different pay grade from the single women who weren't with anybody and didn't have children. I remember getting some of the worst shifts, the weekends and the nights, because the family people were either being awarded or demanding better hours so they could be home for bath time. I totally support them, but I didn't realise it would come at a cost
to you personally.
Me personally, and that did include my health, but also I was single and I would have liked to be a family person, and who was I going to meet on a Monday morning,
yeah,
when I wasn't at work? I remember I worked 6 months of weekends once. You know, it's not terrible, it's not impossible. But it wasn't right and it wasn't fair. Or maybe it was right, but it wasn't fair.
Yeah.
It was right to support family people, and that was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Those are just a few of the examples I personally have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say a broad brush of lots of things are wrong. I think that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I had a wonderful cello teacher when I was a child called Mrs. Perfect, and she really was.
Was that her name?
It was her name, Mrs.
Beautiful.
Perfect. And she was married to Mr. Perfect, and she said he was too. And I remember as I left after A-levels, and she said, it's all right to be angry, she said, but if you become bitter over what happens to you on life's journey, she said, then you've lost. It's all right to be angry, but if you become bitter, then you've lost.
Mm.
And I've taken that as a beautiful life learning.
Yeah.
And I think it relates to what the Fawcett Society is trying to shift societally and what so many individuals are campaigning for, either officially or in quietly in their everyday lives.
There's been so much progress, and you said that in a lot of your responses. I'm interested to know, because we're all on a journey here, what's our part in continuing the campaign for future generations, and the extent to which some of these themes are played out in the work that you do and the experiences you've had?
As a coach, I have privileged, exciting and deep access to very senior leaders, both male and female leaders, and also to the leaders of tomorrow, emergent leaders, bright employees who've got a bit of sparkle and are seen as very high potential in the workplace, be that in for-profit companies, the commercial sector, the public sector, or the NGO, the development aid sector. And I coach across about 35 different cultures, tribes, nationalities, and organisational systems. And the potential for global thinking about leadership, global thinking about societal advance and equality, and global thinking about women,
yes,
is immense, and it's exciting. I think senior leaders, as a coach, I can challenge their assumptions. Many of the white male leaders assume that they are kind of fine and they've worked very hard, and they have, but many of them don't realise that they have already enjoyed bias,
advantage and
yeah, bias, because they were white and they were male. And many of them are finding that this is now falling away, and that is quite threatening. And I say that with compassion, not a desire to enjoy threat experienced by others.
Yes.
As women are coming through, and we hope as a diversity of men and women and agendas and experiences and religions and sexual preferences come through into a workplace where it is safe to be who you are And it's shown that when you are who you are, you succeed more. You're more creative, you're more productive, and that means if you're a commercial organisation, you make more money for them. I would say something I'm also excited about, as well as access to very senior people, is being open to what we can learn from today's 25 to 35 year olds. And in one company, I had a very brave CEO in a career electronics firm, and he experimented with reverse mentoring from somebody who was 25 years younger. And I thought that was brave on both sides, because he was a pretty daunting chap and pretty senior.
Yep.
And the other chap was pretty bright, but pretty young. And I thought it took bravery and humility on the part of the senior leader to see what he could learn from the junior guy.
Yes.
And it worked very well. I'm really into multi-generations as well as multicultural exchanges. And when I was the young one, I always learned from older people. I found them so wise, and always wondered how they managed to know everything.
Yes.
And now I'm sort of a bit in between, learning from the older and wiser, and those who've calmed down a little on their journey and can see more clearly than maybe I can.
Yes.
And also learning from the much younger generations, and even children. It's always been said children come out with the most amazing wisdom sometimes. So I think it's for adults to stay curious.
Yes.
And remember to listen.
I've asked each of my centenary walkers, who are the women that inspire them? So from your perspective, Rachel, who are the women that inspire you?
I think I've got a few really famous ones, and then two or three really personal ones. So in terms of the famous ones, I was sent as a young reporter, I was about 25, to meet Maya Angelou and to interview her, and we didn't have the internet then. So I didn't really know anything about her, and I couldn't find out till I got there. And she just spoke to me and told me she had been abused, sexually abused, and after that she went mute and she didn't speak for a number of years. And I know this is now in the public domain, but I found it remarkable that this woman who had only just met me was prepared to share on that level.
Yes.
And actually, isn't she role modelling how that should be normal? That you can tell people what happened to you and get help.
And be heard.
And be heard.
Yes.
So there was an education there, and I think she knew what she was doing, and I was terribly naive, and she knew that she was giving me a gift of learning.
Yes.
In that experience. Jenny Murray, I'm another massive fan of Jenny Murray. I feel she really connects with all three generations of women or men simultaneously. And I think that should be something we're all aiming for. My grandfather lived to be 97, and he had people 30 years younger coming to his funeral because he made friends with people of different generations. And the way Jenny Murray is on air, she creates this intimate, kind, caring space where women can express their story, some of them, as we know, sharing intensely vulnerable,
yes,
subject matter with us. And yet she can also connect with a young 20-something skateboarder,
yes,
across a culture she may know nothing about, and yet she does it with such genuine curiosity and excitement and enthusiasm. And I would say that young people, my experience is that they really relate to her. She does mothering on air.
Yes.
And that young people really relate to her. So let's not make the mistake of thinking you need a young person to relate to young people. You need a great person, a deep person, a person with empathy and a sense of humour to relate.
Yes. And generosity of spirit and time and attention.
Well, that's what your grandma gives you, isn't it? Or
yeah,
your favourite auntie.
Yeah.
And I have a couple of those in my personal female role model favourites. One is the maternity nurse who came to help my mother when I was born, and now my parents stayed in touch with her, and she lived to be 100 and always said, send Rachel down to come and see me, and I did go and see her.
Lovely.
And she was an international career woman. She had 10 days spare to come and see my parents, who couldn't afford to pay for any more help, but her usual clients would engage her for 2 to 5 years, And she worked across various continents of the globe. And I had never met an international career woman of this sort before. She bought her own house in cash because they wouldn't give a woman a mortgage in the 50s. There was the risk she might marry, not be able to pay it back. So she had to save up in cash. She paddled her own canoe. She'd been through two world wars and the Spanish flu epidemic. And all of that compromised the opportunities for her to marry and have children. And in the end, one could argue she had 60 children. She raised 60 children.
Yes.
Or helped bring 60 children, get them latched onto the breast and give them that
start.
Beautiful start in life that secures so much else if it goes well. So there's the maternity nurse. There's Miss Ross, my favourite teacher at school. And we always used to say, oh great, it's Miss Ross's lesson. No work, just talking. And my mum used to say, what do you mean no work, just talking? And what it was is she would bring in a leaf or a chestnut or a poem or something to look at. And she would ask us to describe it. And when we described it, she would ask us to describe more. And you found more and more and more words in your vocabulary. And I am sure that this has informed the way I'm able to express myself, both in writing and verbally today, but also the way I'm able to look and look again,
yeah,
and see more. And I think as a coach, one is often asking, what can you see? What did you not see or not notice that you now see is there?
Mm. Who are the men that inspire us in the work that we do? Because this is a journey that necessarily needs to involve women. We're talking about feminism, but we need men on the wagon too. So from your perspective, who are the men who inspire you in the work that you do?
I met a male CEO in the NHS outside the toilets on my master's degree course in executive coaching. And he said, oh, by the way, you've got all the hallmarks of a CEO. And I said, oh, that's funny, Phil, because only one of us is a CEO and it isn't me. It was him. I'd never met a CEO before.
Yeah.
But because of that conversation, I grew. It was like feed forward. You know, instead of telling someone how they've done, you're telling them how they could do, what they could be, the potential that you see in them. And that feed forward fed into my self-esteem. There's a confident duck for you, you see, female, of course. And I did become a mini CEO of my own company. And I then started to win business from CEOs, chief executives, managing directors of companies. I'd never been so high up in firms. And now suddenly they were recruiting me to help them do their jobs better.
Yeah.
Another male, when I was bidding for continued funding for the human rights media project I was leading in Afghanistan, the former Soviet Union, later asked to consult for India and also Kenya, I go to see the head of, basically the head of money at the Foreign Office, and it was a man, and he championed this work, and he was the one that showed me. It didn't have to be a man holding the purse strings who said yes, but to have a man holding the purse strings who was so excited and driven by the need for this kind of work was a wonderful experience for me in my first leadership position. I had a team of one.
Yeah.
And I went to my boss and said, oh, I can't do this. I'm a fitter in. I'm a team member. And he said, he leant forward and he said, well, I said, I've never done this before. And he leant forward and he said, well, nor have I. And that was the most splendid vacuum for me to jump into, try ideas out, find that they worked, and grow as a person.
And it's those encounters that have a lasting effect. And what I'm hearing you say, they open doors, don't they? And they open possibilities that you wouldn't have granted for yourself, maybe. You could have done, but it just took that conversation.
I think opening doors into firms or onto courses or into contacts is all very helpful, and I certainly need help and luck. I'm very happy to put the work in, but work isn't enough. You need luck as well.
Yeah.
But opening the doors within yourself is even more powerful. because from there you know you can do it. You know you can achieve something you didn't know you could achieve, or you didn't even know was out there to try for.
Yes.
And I think that's another very exciting thing to enable girls, for example, not news to this generation, but it was news 100 years ago, 50 years ago, girls in science, girls in engineering, girls in construction. It's opening the door to say, we expect girls to be in here. And yes. Now they are.
Yes. And with that, as a parent, what are your hopes for future generations?
So I'd like to make it clear that I don't only value people who are or who are able to be parents. I think there is parenting everywhere. There is a role that leaders play at work where they are shepherding or offering a parenting of sorts and hopefully healthy role modelling to junior employees and indeed to their peers. There is care and concern from friends and for friends. But when I was in the position of having new babies or very young children, I remember saying to a friend, I've never done so little for my fellow man before. I used to work in human rights and now I barely get beyond the living room rug.
Yeah.
And I felt my world had really closed in and I was offering nothing to the outside world. And yet I'm bringing up the next generation to be, I hope, good people and contributors of good and progress in the outside world.
One of the questions I'm asking everybody is, in this journey to be the person we want to be, to support others and the work that we're doing, who are the people, the unsung heroes that actually we want to thank? So who are the people on your list to thank?
I feel passionately that my parents created a home that welcomed and included people from many different cultures. Theirs was a mixed marriage and people always said, oh, if we've got someone visiting, let's come over to the Ellison household because they'll know how to handle this. And my parents were able to welcome anybody of any standing from any country and from any religion, and including any dietary requirements, at the drop of a hat. Their minds were open, even if they didn't quite know what to do. They were open to learning and they were receptive and they were welcoming. And both sets of grandparents that I had very different socioeconomic backgrounds, and one side had a refugee journey to the UK as a result of the Second World War. And those two sets of grandparents ended up going on holidays together. They got on so well, even though they were so different. And the story of the refugee grandparents, their story of survival, resilience, of learning multiple different languages, of setting yourself up in business when you've arrived, carrying what you can carry in your hands. I think these are stories that are very inspiring and very anchoring. So I really give thanks for the narrative. And I also feel so thankful for a couple of deeply inspiring teachers and a couple of best ever ex-bosses who enabled my creativity to flourish, who helped me get out of stuck and know how to get myself out of stuck next time, and now others out of stuck and closed and resigned and hopeless into opportunity and excitement and what I call that wonderful positive upward spiral of life.
As an author myself, having given birth to a book about mentoring new parents at work, I'm actually thrilled to know that you are just about to embark and launch your own book. And do you want to tell us a bit about it?
I'd love to. My book is called Global Leadership and Coaching: Flourishing Under Intense Pressure at Work. And it came about by accident. I never had a particular desire to leave a book on earth, and now there is one. And it came about because I was coaching leaders in the world of elite high performance sport, in international non-governmental development aid, in government, in the public sector, in health, in prisons. And some of what they were telling me within their confidential coaching session was so inspiring and showed such high passion and high humility that I asked their permission, could I take down their case history and create learning for others. And I did this within the bounds of ethics and best practice of my industry. And it was wonderful what these leaders shared. I asked two questions. What does it take to be an effective leader in your field? And what can the rest of us learn if we have a completely different type of job and are never going to end up working in a refugee camp or in a prison or in a hospital? And what was remarkable is each leader was totally clear on how what they'd learned about leadership and about working life could be applied to anyone going to any office in any city in the world. And in fact, one lovely example was of a leader who said, "We need humanitarian aid, even in the most dullest of offices." I said, "Oh, how's that?" And she said, "Well, just think about what people give up, how hard they work, staying late in the office, the stress that they either create for others or endure themselves, the bullying." She said, "This often comes at the cost of their own health and them seeing their families." She said, "We need humanitarian aid in the office and managers need to consider supplying that." And another leader said, "We need people like you to write a book like this," she said, "because I'm working in Iraq and I haven't got time to write it." She said, "But I want this learning to reach my daughters earlier than it reached me." So that's what I'd wish for the future generations, that they have access to the learning and wisdom that I may have only come across age 45, and that they can have it at 25.
That sounds a really, really exciting book to get. And as you say, it crosses all boundaries. So if people want to find out more, how will they find your book?
It crosses 40 different cultures, and hopefully it releases any boundaries such that people can learn, enjoy
Great.
And go out. And my ambition for this book is that people lead better by this afternoon. And you can find it on my website, rachelellison.com, or on Amazon and Routledge. It's Global Leadership and Coaching by Rachel Ellison.
Rachel, thank you for sharing this walk with me today. It's been absolutely fascinating and I appreciate you giving your time. Thank you.
It's lovely to join you. How many kilometres have we got to go?